Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a rescheduling conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Rescheduling, that's a hot topic today in the marijuana debate. I've been painfully years ahead of my time in terms of drug policy. It started with prescription painkillers. Sadly, the medical community, including myself at the beginning, drank the Kool-Aid in prescribing opioids. We did not critically analyze the science and fell for the industry data and society pressure to prescribe. The safety data was not fully analyzed, and excuses were made to dismiss negative effects. I was on the forefront of resisting that trend. Now I see many, including some in the medical community, drinking that same Kool-Aid again, but when it comes to marijuana. The harms are right in front of our eyes, but we ignore the data and follow the industry talking points just like we did in the OxyContin days. Rescheduling of marijuana implies changing the status of the drug under the Controlled Substance Act, the CSA. The CSA is a statute established by the federal U.S. drug policy under which the manufacture, importations, possession, use, and distribution of certain substances are regulated. It was passed in 1970 and signed into law by President Richard Nixon. Two federal agencies, the DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, and the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, determine which substances are added to or removed from the various schedules. The legislation created five schedules of drugs, from Schedule 1, the most restrictive, to Schedule 5, the least restrictive. The CSA described the schedule based on three factors: 1, potential for abuse; 2, accepted medical use; and 3, safety and potential for addiction. The CSA is set to follow binding scientific and medical findings of a public health authority. The legal public health authority is the Secretary of Health and Human Services Agency. In addition, the CSA is associated with international treaty obligations. If the United States reschedules marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, while the United Nations still maintains marijuana as a Schedule 1, the U.S. will be in conflict with international law. That makes things messy. We have the right to withdraw from the international treaty, but then if we don't want to follow international law, how can we expect China and Mexico to follow the law and stop pushing fentanyl on the United States? If the U.S. withdraws from international drug treaties, how does that affect other international treaties like the ones for, say, nuclear weapons? People think we're just talking about pot. What's the big deal? The big deal is not just our own public health safety, but the integrity of the FDA medication process and the integrity of the United States with international treaties. To learn about the science of marijuana and rescheduling debate, I reach out to my colleagues at ISAC, the International Academy in the Science and Impact of Cannabis, Dr. Eric Voth, Dr. Libby Stout, and Dr. Bertha Madras. Dr. Eric Voth is a physician specializing in internal medicine, pain management, and addiction medicine. He advised several presidential administrations on drug policy and testified in numerous congressional offices on drug-related issues. Dr. Voth serves as president and chairman of the board of the International Academy and the Science and Impact of Cannabis. Dr. Libby Stout is a returning guest on High Truths. Check out her previous episode. She is a psychiatrist in Colorado, ground zero for marijuana proliferation. She has many years of experience treating people with severe cannabis use disorder and cannabis-associated psychosis. She serves as secretary for Isaac. Dr. Bertha Madras is professor of psychobiology at Harvard Medical School and former deputy director for demand reduction at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, ONDCP. She has numerous scientific publications, courses, patents, and awards. Dr. Madras is part of the Isaac Expert Scientific Council. She, too, is a repeat guest at High Truth, so you should check out her other episodes. To learn more about Dr. Eric Voth, Dr. Libby Stout, Dr. Bertha Madras, and the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, Isaac, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Eric Voth, Dr. Libby Stout, Dr. Bertha Madras, welcome to High Truth.
Thank you.
So, Eric, Libby, Bertha, you've all been on the show before, but I want to, like, once again, refamiliarize the audience with you. You're all extremely passionate about the issue of marijuana. Please share with us, what is the root of that passion? And Eric, let's start with you.
Well, coming out of college and med school, had a lot of friends that got into trouble with pot, and had a couple family members, and I got thinking, you know, maybe this isn't just such a simple play thing. And then as I finished my training, I had the opportunity to actually open up a chemical dependence unit, and for 10 years was the medical director there and saw a huge amount of difficulty with marijuana. And that was at a time that the THC content was minimal, you know, a few percent. But yet, I would say 50% of the people coming in either had mixed problems with dependence on marijuana and other drugs, or solely on marijuana. And that was also at the time when people started to change the name to cannabis to kind of buff it up a little bit. But I knew it as marijuana. And honestly, either one really fits. So as time went on then, I had the opportunity to join some anti-drug groups like NFP. And my attitude was, heaven's sakes, if it's got medical properties, let's use it. That's wonderful. And a couple of the really terrific anti-drug folks said, wait a minute, you need to wake up and take a look at this. It's an addictive drug. And so from there forward, I started paying really close attention to it. And then in the 80s, when I heard one of the leadership of the normal marijuana movement say, quotes, we plan to use the medicinal uses of marijuana as a way to get the camel's nose under the tent, I was dumbstruck. I realized, wow, we've been taken, we've been lied to, and I started getting very involved, both in the cannabis issue and also in the medical cannabis issue, because they're separate, but they're very closely tied together. And then through the years, worked with several organizations, and then just a few years ago, decided to pull the Isaac group together because I wanted to have physicians and scientists, no one else kind of, you know, muddying the waters and you know, really getting the medical picture out there. And I think we've done that, and we've been a real reliable entity that has truth and not a lot of scare tactics. And, you know, we're really telling people, hey, wake up. This is a serious medical problem.
Yeah. Libby, what about you?
Well, I'm an addiction psychiatrist in Colorado, and I was fortunate to run a pretty wonderful program that really doesn't exist anywhere else in the country, but a 90-day inpatient treatment program funded by the state of Colorado at the state hospital for people with co-occurring disorders. And so I've been doing this for a very long time. And yeah, I, like Eric, I've treated people. Cannabis was a problem, but it was never a really big problem until we legalized recreational in Colorado. And that was we opened the doors in 2014. And then in 2015, we got a law that said people on probation can use medical marijuana as long as a doctor recommends it. And since 80% of the people I was treating were there as a condition of probation, parole, or diversion, people just flocked to using it. And I started seeing things I had never seen before. I was kind of blown away by like the worst psychosis I have ever seen, worse than methamphetamine. People with cannabis use disorder as their primary diagnosis. I hadn't seen that before either. And then people with really severe delusions, really poor mental health, and they really couldn't do the program. It was a very high intensive cognitive behavioral program. And it was really clear that it was affecting them negatively. And so I was telling people about this and people would say, oh, that can't be, that's just marijuana. And that's what got me interested in really looking into the science. And so I've done an exhaustive research of everything I can. And then joining Isaac was really great because I think it's really important that people know the science and follow the science. And that's really why I keep doing what I'm doing.
That's great. And Bertha, what about you?
I came in this through two different venues. One was through public policy and one was through neuroscience. So I'm not the in-between, which means the clinical practice, having a face time and face value with individuals who've been using. In terms of public policy, I was asked by the U.S. Department of Justice to present as an expert witness on the desire of a concerted group to reschedule marijuana in 2014. And by that time, I was very familiar with the drug. Every single criteria used by the FDA to approve drugs, every criteria used by the DEA to schedule drugs, and every single manuscript in the literature on the medical applications of marijuana. And I came to the conclusion unequivocally that marijuana should not be put into Schedule 3 because the evidence for it, based on FDA standards, which are the gold standard, not only for this country, but for the world, based on FDA standards, marijuana did not qualify because of safety and efficacy concerns. And so with that knowledge, I went ahead in front of a judge, in front of a court case, against about 9 lawyers, representatives from Normal and other entities that want to legalize marijuana, and the Department of Justice, and we won. We won the case unequivocally that marijuana should not be rescheduled. Within the same time frame, the World Health Organization asked me to update the literature on the medical uses of cannabis. And for me, that was quite simple. I had done all the homework. I had scoured the literature from about 1960 onwards, and it was so obvious that the data simply are not there for approving marijuana, generic marijuana, whatever that means, as a medicine. So from that perspective, it was very clear to me. From the other side of the coin, I was very familiar with the basic biology and realized that not only is the drug not innocuous, not only is it not harmless, not only is it addictive, but there are certain effects that it can promote in the brain, which I thought were very contrary to normal, healthy brains. And so from those two perspectives, I have been a zealot in trying to push back on the train for legalizing, medicalizing, and normalizing this drug in society.
And we could add now commercializing.
Well, commercialization, once you legalize a drug, it is very difficult to to prevent commercialization, because you can pass small ordinances, you can pass small regulations about where you can put up stores. But once you legalize a drug, it is extremely difficult to suppress its commercialization throughout the country.
Right, thanks. So all of us here are part of the Isaac team, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, we're not necessarily prohibitionists, but we are very pro-science, as you can hear that. Eric, as president of the organization, just give us a few words about it for our audience.
Well, first of all, that point is really good. We're not a bunch of prohibitionists. We are scientists, we're physicians. We understand and have studied the literature. And one of the things that I repeatedly point out is that if there's some reason that we need THC, Delta 9, or, you know, THC, we have that already in Marinol. It's a Schedule 3 medicine. I've used it in very rare patients anymore, but pain and certain other disorders. So that's available. But you can't extrapolate then to say, well, if we have Marinol, we need marijuana. That'd be very much like saying we have morphine. Well, let's legalize heroin. And so, you know, really what we need to look at is what are the indications? What actually works? Where's the science? You know, and then what should be approved? And I think there's absolutely no question. I totally agree with Dr. Madras that this is being driven by the cannabis lobby, period. It's really a worry to me because we're seeing now such incredibly strong concentrations of THC. You know, these are, you know, frankly toxic substances. Just as an example, if you were talking about Marinol, you're talking about 5 milligrams of THC. If we're talking about the current smoked pot, so a joint, that would be about a gram of that substance. It's around 20 to 30% THC. That's 200 to 300 milligrams of THC, much less the oils, the vapes, et cetera, that are pushing 70, 80, 90% THC. So we've got this toxic substance out there that they're talking about trying to make readily available to the public. I think that is totally flawed and a terrible mistake. We, being Isaac, are all interested in the issue. We are all scientists or physicians. We understand all of the implications, and we're not doing it to be prohibitionists. We're doing it to be the scientists and physicians that we came into this being.
Right. And make a point that all the members of Isaac, all the physicians and scientists are all volunteers. You're not paid to be here. And you dedicate many, many hours really on behalf of the science and having an informed public.
Absolutely true.
So let's get into the issue. Let's dial it back. Where did all this movement to reschedule come from? And Bertha, you kind of mentioned you were right there in 2014. Does this date back even further?
My involvement with marijuana dates back to 1991 because I was awarded by NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, a grant to develop a museum exhibit on how psychoactive drugs affect the brain. The grant was very complicated. It was very challenging. But in what I decided to do is feature 8 different categories of drugs, one of which was marijuana. And I developed and received a lot of pushback from people throughout the community that I was working in, including in academia, including museum exhibitors, on slow walking or backtracking on what I had learned about marijuana. And that was 1991, when the doses were very low. Concentration of THC was around 3 to 5%. But I already knew the literature probably in somewhat greater depth than the colleagues who were pushing back and saying it's an innocent drug. And please don't say anything negative about it. At that point, I started to follow the entire progress of marijuana from 1991 onwards and watch very carefully what was happening in California with the Compassionate Use Act, which was designed to medicalize it. And I never stopped following the progression of the political movement and the movement by zealots to promote this drug. So my history goes back well over 22 years.
So this whole issue of rescheduling is not overnight. This has been in the making for a while.
Well, there is a video of 1979 which is available on YouTube showing that the zealots that wanted from San Francisco that wanted to legalize marijuana had decided that the way to legalize it was first to medicalize it. Once you medicalize, the public loses their guard in terms of whether or not it's a psychoactive drug that could have hazards. Once it's approved as a medicine, then you begin to normalize drug use and you begin to disseminate its use as safe, effective, and harmless for casual use. That's precisely the playbook. And it's the playbook now that we're seeing with regard to hallucinogens as well. So, you know, after 30 years of watching this unfold, I knew the scenario very well. I was quite familiar with the players who were involved, with the billionaires who were involved in supporting the medicalization and then legalization, and their strategies of going from state to state to state, spending millions of dollars in each state, figuring out what angle should be used in order to convince that state and those particular demographics on voting for a medicine unheard of, unprecedented, other than Laetril in our history. We never voted on what is and what is not a medicine. And somehow they managed to convince the people of California via a ballot initiative that they should vote and decide on a medicine, which is marijuana. I cannot imagine how this is going to erode the FDA, not only the FDA integrity, but also the integrity of our medicines in the future if we allow this type of initiative to continue.
I agree. That's what scares me above all, is the integrity of my own profession. But this, all of a sudden now, this hot topic of scheduling, where all need to get our letters out and people are lobbying, that started off with a letter from Health and Human Services, Dr. Rachel Levine. Who wants to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think that's the issue, because I have obtained something that someone who works in government, and I don't want to disclose who that is, but submitted some comments to the Department of Justice, and, you know, saying that they thought that the definition of marijuana should be expanded to include not just Delta 9 THC, but Delta 8, all the isomers and, you know, all the things that you can make out of hemp. And basically, they got replies back from the Department of Justice. And so they're basically saying that HHS conducted a scientific and medical evaluation, which is binding on the Attorney General until the issuance of a notice of proposed rulemaking. And HHS ultimately recommended that marijuana be placed in Schedule 3. And so it's, you know, here we are responding to the Department of Justice, and we're trying to give them reasons why they shouldn't reschedule it. But this is all coming from Human Services. And I don't know, what literature are they looking at? Because my biggest concern with this is when you say cannabis, and what under the current definition of what that is, it's basically Delta 9 THC, a certain percentage.
And there lies problem one with this whole initiative. We don't know what the definition is of marijuana.
Exactly.
It's a free-for-all.
So, And so then it applies to everything. So I have all these patients that are dabbing, you know, shatter, wax, they're vaping high potency hash oil as medicine, because in Colorado and elsewhere, it's been allowed to be heavily advertised and marketed as medicine. And so again, people do think it's safe. They think it's effective. And there, in my experience, I can't find it yet. There is no validated science on any of these high potency products.
Yeah, Bertha, you've studied the literature more than anybody, millions of articles. Have we ever studied these was there any been clinical trials on these high potency dabs or on these, Delta 8 products or on any of the stuff that's really out in the market right now? Was that ever studied in a medical fashion?
Absolutely not. To the best of my knowledge, there are two papers, one coming from the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research in California, the CNCR, which studied as high as 10% THC for neuropathic pain. And in fact, they showed that 10% had too many adverse events. And so they study three doses, and the middle dose, somewhere between, I believe, 3 and 10%, it may have been 6%, was okay. The other study came from Israel in Crohn's disease, in which they studied 20% THC and said that patients self-reported improvement in their symptoms, but they had no biometric analysis of whether or not there was actual disease remission or improvement. And so that paper was very heavily criticized. Anyone who says that being in Schedule 1 prevents you from studying dabs and shatters is simply not accurate, because cannabidiol was in Schedule 1 until GW Pharmaceuticals began to study it in typical cases of seizure disorders in children, and Dravet's and Lennox-Gastaut. And they were able to do all the clinical trials they wanted and get it FDA approved. So there is nothing holding an individual, an industry back from studying very potent forms of marijuana, of THC, which are very highly concentrated forms of marijuana. There's nothing holding them back. There's a lot of paperwork. There's a lot of documentation. But so what? GW Pharmaceuticals did it with cannabidiol. A person, an industry, a company, an entity can do the same with high potency, and it has not been done.
Well, every drug company does that. They spend millions on going through phase 1, 2, 3 trials for improving medications. They do that. It's not an easy process. It's meant not to be an easy process in order to safeguard the public.
It's billions of dollars. It's thousands of pages of documentation. It is so much easier for the industry and for the zealots to simply make a substance, market it through their dispensaries without going through the FDA, without going through all the hard work and the scientific validation that's necessary to get FDA approval. All you have to do is go state by state and get the public lured into believing it's a medicine, and then you can literally sell and market anything you want in these dispensaries, up to 90% THC, without evidence, without proof, without safety, without efficacy, with no data whatsoever. And that is the playbook that's been used in the marijuana industry in the United States in 2024.
Yeah, dangerous, slippery slope. Let's go through the various reasons for opposing rescheduling, and why is this a bad idea? Eric, why don't you want to get us started? What are the main reasons to oppose it?
Well, first of all, as far as the rescheduling issue, there's no proof. Like, for instance, one of the things that would push a little bit towards Schedule 3 is if all of a sudden there was a big group of clear evidence, you know, that was showing, you know, hey, we're seeing big changes here. And there really is not. There, the definition of currently accepted medical use does not apply to any of these other forms of marijuana. Now, we do have Marinol. It does exist. It is Schedule 3. It is prescribable. So one could strongly argue there's no need for something else that's going to have the same major active ingredient, just vastly higher doses of it. The other thing that I think we've got to pay attention to is if we just start tinkering with all of these criteria, what's that going to do downstream with other meds that are going to come up and be reviewed? Is it going to completely negate the FDA or the FDA processes? I don't know. But I do worry about that because God knows there's a lot of just junk out there that could come to pass if we don't have those criteria that drugs are held to.
I agree. And I think that existential threat to the entire way of approving medications and to the medical community at large is really the biggest issue besides the public health issue. In order to be Schedule 3, you have to meet three criteria, according to CSA. Abuse potential, medium. We know there's abuse potential and medium, whether you want to call it high, medium, low. Let's give you that. There is addiction potential. It could even be severe mental or moderate physical. And, you know, whether something severe or moderate, we can give you that. But then there's accepted medical use. And I think that's the part here. Is it accepted medical use to use marijuana, a plant with 500 different chemicals, 60 different cannabinoids, many of which have not been studied, and that includes toxins and carcinogens and other things?
Well, I would say absolutely not. I mean, this is kind of a by fiat move to just say, go to Schedule 3, don't worry about the criteria. We got the criteria for a reason. And yeah, absolutely. That's probably one of the most important, you know, which is currently accepted medical use. For what? Now, THC, yes, in Marinol, but you've already got that as a Schedule 3 drug. So what do we need all this toxic milieu for? And, you know, what are there now? What, 80 some cannabinoids alone, 500 substances? Typically in quote marijuana or cannabis. I mean, that's just a toxic brew.
Right. And Libby, you were, as we were talking a little bit earlier about, you mentioned about Laetril. Is there precedence, or any of you answer, is there precedence for the FDA to approve a plant? We have many medications that are plant-based. Digoxin, a heart medication, comes from an oleander plant, but we don't approve the oleander plant. We approve the digoxin. Is there any precedence in the history of the world to approve a total plant?
Well, I don't think so. And Bertha did mention the Laetril issue. Oh. That was a vote by the populace, and people really wanted it, not realizing it was basically a deadly concoction. And that's, to me, the biggest problem is going to be if they want to put it as a Schedule 3, they're going to have to come up with the dosing. And no studies have done that. I mean, there are all of these studies of benefit are pretty much anecdotal, and they haven't done, you know, randomized people to different doses, and then looked at efficacy and problematic problems, except for all the stuff that is less than 10%. And you know, most of the research we have is based on Sativex or Nabiximols, which, because they're available pretty much everywhere else except for this country. And that's still a very controlled drug that has very consistent dosing. So 2.7 milligrams of THC, 2.5 milligrams of CBD per inhaler, per dose. And so that's, to me, is going to be a big problem. And then it's, you know, also the packaging. Some of the biggest problems we have in Colorado are all these things are still available in child desiring kind of things, like gummies and candies. And now, because if this sets a precedent, like you just said, we're going to see the same thing with psychedelics, because we're already seeing this with psilocybin in Colorado, where they're coming up with confectioners and, you know, putting it in chocolates and gummies, and they're concentrating it. And so if we set this precedent with marijuana, it's just going to go to everything, I think.
Well, one thing I was going to add that I've been investigating is the malpractice impact. I've done a lot of malpractice work through the years as an expert witness. And one of the things that malpractice actions leans on is deviation from the standard of care, i.e., what is the standard of care? To have a single reliable substance, not to have 500 or 100 or whatever. And if people start having psychotic episodes, violence episodes, suicides, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, from even if it's an FDA-approved medicine, they're going to start seeing lawsuits come out of that. And I would say, you know, beware practitioners and beware states of deviation from the standard of care, which is to have a good, reliable, researched medication of a pure medication. So we'll see, but I wouldn't be surprised at all to see that start hitting.
There are three things I would love to add on to. One is the Laetrile episode, which happened in the 1970s. Laetrile is an extract of apricot pits, and it was being touted state by state as a cure for cancer by the person who patented it, by the way. And they managed to get 17 states to approve it by ballot initiative until the FDA decided to partner with HHS, with NIH, and develop clinical trials through NIH grants. And they found the first step they did was actually poll physicians across the country. And a handful said that they thought their patients got better, a handful, which can happen with cancer in the rare lucky people, of course, untreated. But then what they did was sponsor these clinical trials and found that not only is it completely ineffective, but it actually was hazardous to people with or without cancer. And that was the end of Laetrile. But you can see how dangerous that slope became with marijuana. So that's history number one lesson. Number two is, what are the criteria for a physician to prescribe as opposed to recommend marijuana? And will they be able to prescribe it now as opposed to recommending it, which is currently the only avenue they have except possibly in Louisiana? Here is the issue. California, in its wisdom, in the ballot initiative, and as I said, these were very clever people who organized the entire strategy. Part of the clause in the Proposition 215 was to prevent physicians from getting sued if they recommended marijuana. In other words, the State Board of Medicine in California was not allowed to go after physicians. And that's part of the strategy, is to try to protect the physicians who are recommending something that's not FDA approved. Now, I don't know how other states, whether or not they would follow suit, but there could be these kind of recommendations in other states. I'm not up to date to it. But the real question is, what does a physician actually recommend or prescribe? do they prescribe something that's orally bioavailable, or is it a liquid? Is it a gummy bear? Is it a brownie? Is it smoked THC? Is it vape THC? At what dose? How frequently? And what are the contraindications with regard to pregnancy or people under the age of 18 or the elderly who are suffering some form of memory loss? None of this. What are the pharmacokinetics, the pharmacodynamics? None of these recommend, none of these criteria that the FDA uses in order to approve a medicine, and as well as post-marketing surveillance, none of these have applied to marijuana. Right now, the butt tenders in so-called medical dispensaries are the ones giving advice to patients. Oh, you have a sleep problem, try this strain, Purple Kush, or try, it's complete and total science fiction. It is based on anecdote, it's based on pure personal opinions, personal advice, personal anecdotes. There isn't a science behind it.
It's amazing. I mean, why, I have two daughters who went through medical school. Why go to med school or nursing school or pharmacy school when you could just skirt things and kind of have this process where you could give whatever you want? I'm amazed that the HHS report, the Health and Human Services report, and under the CSA, the public health authority for making schedule recommendations is the head of HHS. So I imagine that's why the letter came from Dr. Levine. But the report's a 90-page document. And the conclusion, let me read you a little bit of that conclusion so you can tell me the problem here. But they say more than 30,000 HCPs, I assume that stands for healthcare providers, are certified to recommend the use of marijuana for more than 6 million registered patients, constituting widespread clinical experience associated with various medical conditions recognized by a substantial number of jurisdictions across the United States. For several jurisdictions, these programs have been in place for several years and include features that actively monitor medical use and product quality characteristics of marijuana dispense. A loaded paragraph, and I think like every single sentence has several flaws, but let me give that paragraph the conclusion of why this should be moved to the schedule. What's the problem there?
Well, I would like to say that from Colorado's perspective, that is a bunch of hogwash. No, I'm sorry. The reality is we have less than 0.1% of the physicians in Colorado recommending cannabis to their patients. And in fact, the majority of patients are receiving it from a very small number of physicians. And having worked with many clients who have red cards or medical cards, the physician recommending the marijuana never follows them up. So they never know what the outcome is. They don't, and they don't recommend what to use. Just a real quick case example, young lady vaping 60% hash oil every single day. She ended up with a very serious suicide attempt, was hospitalized, diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I follow her up after the hospitalization, and I don't get a history of bipolar at all. But I do get this history of her vaping 60% hash oil every day. And they didn't get that history in the hospital because they didn't ask the questions and they didn't do a urine drug screen. But I said, what is that for? And she said, oh, that's for my migraine headaches. And I said, are you telling me that a doctor recommended that you vape 60% THC for your migraine headaches? And she said, well, no, that's what the bud tender told me. And so this is something that, you know, she's been doing for some time. And when I asked about the suicide attempt, she said, I don't know what happened. That came out of the blue. I never, ever thought about suicide before, but all of a sudden I felt like I needed to kill myself. And so then I shared with her the literature that's out there correlating marijuana use and suicide. And she actually agreed that maybe that was causing her problem. And then she said, well, then I should probably quit. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. Do you think you can? And she told me, well, yeah, sure. Well, I see her a month later and she's not been able to quit, even though she thought it would be very simple. And then she realized that she's really very dependent on it and she can't quit, which is very, very sad. And this was all from a doctor who got paid to see her for, 5 minutes. And that's the other thing that is happening here in Colorado is you can get a medical card online with just a few minutes with no physical examination, no evaluation of other medical records. In fact, they're not even keeping medical records because it's very hard to get medical records from a doctor who's been recommending marijuana to a patient. So, I mean, there are so many problems that I don't know how that's going to get fixed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The perfect example, Libby, thank you so much for mentioning it, because it is completely contrary to good practice of medicine. And it's being tolerated. The fact that HHS is endorsing it, from my perspective, is literally a political decision and not a scientific and medical decision. Because if you excavate, precisely as you said, if you excavate the type of practices that people have when they're recommending marijuana, it is completely outside the playbook in many cases of what they've been taught in medical school, which is a complete physical history. You have to look at the mental health status of the individual, because people who've had psychotic episodes or who are depressed are at very high risk. There's so many contraindications, certainly with pregnant women, certainly with children, with the elderly in terms of cognitive incapacitation or incoordination. There's so many. And there's none of this embedded in the practice of recommending marijuana. It's a tragedy for our country.
It is. I imagine, in the HHS document, it says 6 million registered patients. I would challenge even one of those 6 million patients. Is there a record from the certifiers of medications, medication interactions, allergies, vital signs, past medical history, mental history, anything that usually that every single credentialed physician or even nurse knows to put on a medical record? There's none of that.
And for what medical condition?
Yeah.
One recent survey showed that approximately, I think it was 79% of people who've been recommended marijuana for a medical condition, unspoken, undefined, are also using it for recreational purposes. The entire field is contaminated with pseudoscience and, in fact, with a cloaking device on what the real purpose is of recommending marijuana for the majority of people.
The other thing that is irritating to note is there is an entire specialty of law that's cannabis law. Hundreds of attorneys internationally, sharing this information about how to sort of, get around or how you phrase things. In Kansas, they've not yet passed medical marijuana, but every one of their bills so far has had the immunity for prescribers. So
yes,
there is a very, very well-organized legal buttressing of this whole thing.
But you know what? I've lived through the opioid prescription epidemic. And in California, there was also exemptions to physicians who prescribe opioids for pain, that they won't be held accountable for that. But when people started dying, and that was documented, the legal community and the Medical Board of California did an about face and went after those doctors who prescribed.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen here. Clearly, it shall, because the opioid prescription epidemic was a paradigm of what's happening with marijuana and with hallucinogens currently. And it was to promote the drug as safe and effective a non-addictive for people in pain, and yet it was neither safe nor non-addictive for people in pain. And this is exactly the same playbook that's being used, except that right now, rather than having the industry, in the case of opioids, it was concentrated with a few pharmaceutical companies. Right now, it is not as concentrated. There is vast quantities of money that lobbyists can rely on in order to promote the drug. And once there is a critical mass of money, it's self-perpetuating in terms of lobbying, in terms of regulations, in terms of politics. And unfortunately, it's the political arm of the government that has taken over this particular topic and is beginning to foist this, what I call this entire entity onto the community. I mean, if you substitute marijuana for alcohol, and alcohol used to be recommended by physicians, you begin to get a sense of what this movement is leading to.
I really feel sorry for the public, because not just for marijuana, because if you have a 90-page document from the Health and Human Services saying this is medicine, this is safe, this is monitored, all the things that we see in this document that are just they're false to us physicians and scientists who review this material. None of the science used the high potency products. There was no consideration to the severe mental health impacts. But that's just for marijuana. What is the public supposed to think when it comes to vaccines or COVID or any other public health? I mean, there's a loss of trust in medicine because of this process for politics and for money.
Well, I think there's going to be a loss of trust, not only in medicine, but in a tremendous loss of trust in the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry and the media and every single one of the entities that have contributed to this mess. Because eventually, as happened with the opioids, as happened with cocaine, eventually the public begins to suffer the consequences. And they begin to lobby their politicians to reverse the trends. And when those trends start to reverse, a lot of entities are going to fall.
Well, and I would also say that a lot of us have long memories. That is, until we get to the point that we don't have memories. But the point being, we're going to remember who's doing this stuff. We're going to remember, you know, who in the FDA, who in HHS. I mean, those folks will be held accountable someday. And I feel strongly I'll be one of the ones to do it, because what we're seeing right now is absolutely inappropriate and dangerous and counter anything that's good in medicine.
The HHS letter says that NIDA supports the schedule change.
I don't believe it.
It says that in the letter, but I'm wondering if it's, again, we don't know what to believe. I can't believe, I mean, I know people in DEA, in the CDC, in NIDA do not approve and do not believe that this is science, but I think that maybe they're silenced or, but the document says this is approved by NIDA.
Well, I don't think we can conjecture whether or not it's approved or not. I know that NIDA has to weigh in on it, but I feel that some of the documentation that's been used in order to promote it, in other words, the number of users and the number of people recommending it, I mean, it's being promoted on the basis of the number of people who are recommending and using, rather than whether or not there's good scientific evidence behind it. And I just don't know the position of that. I'd rather not conjecture on it, but it would be very interesting to see whether or not they actually concur with the data and concur with the rationale.
Interesting, because they do mention that in the in Dr. Levine's letter, they do mention NIDA. A lot of people say, you know what, we need to reschedule, that if we rescheduled marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, we could do more research. We already talked about that, that that's not true. But they also say it'll make it safer, it'll be regulated, it would be treated more like a medication. And the other argument is that, well, if we reschedule it, we want to do that because we don't want to criminalize drug possession. And if it's Schedule 1, then people are criminal. Maybe if it's Schedule 3, it'll help with the whole issue of decriminalization. What do you guys think?
Well, I think it's a red herring, for one. I don't think we want to see, you know, low-level users doing jail time. That's just a bad idea. I think it's used as an excuse, because I've watched that from the very beginning. Yes, there are people that went to prison that, you know, or smaller amounts, and that kind of thing can be changed. I think you can also then look at creative ways to use the criminal justice system, such as drug courts. I mean, I think drug courts are brilliant. And you know, you have that gradated intervention and gradated penalties. And I've known a number of patients that have really finally gotten that controlled with the teeth, so to speak, of the criminal justice system. So I think that's largely a red herring. And there are ways to make the criminal justice system work and to have, you know, sobriety for a period of time, and then you get to wipe your criminal history or your history reasonably clean. So I think that's mainly a red herring.
I would agree with Eric on that, mainly because in my entire career of doing this, I have yet to see a single person go to treatment without a consequence. It's consequences that make people decide to get help. And that is really why I've focused most of my career on tobacco, trying to encourage programs to become tobacco-free, like residential and inpatient programs, to improve outcomes. Because if you wait for a consequence for tobacco, it's usually too late. And that is the number one drug that kills people. And so if you have your heart attack, your COPD, your lung cancer. And so that's why I think it's imperative that inpatient residential programs provide an environment where people are able to quit using tobacco. And, you know, the program I ran was, you know, most of them, 80% were there as a condition of probation, some legal problem. And, you know, they would come in angry and say things like, well, they made me come here. And I said, well, no, I think the judge gave you a choice. The judge said you could go to prison or you could go to treatment. And you chose treatment. So you're really here voluntarily. And so I think it's inherent on the programs to make it, you know, attractive to why they should be there. And we need longer times. You know, NIDA says you should have a minimum of 90 days. Nobody gets 90 days inpatient, except we did. And we had great outcomes. And I think that, you know, treatment really does work, but there has to be some impetus for somebody to go to treatment. And that's why I think there needs to be some nuancing with the criminal charges. And I agree that I don't think we should be locking people up who've got small amounts of their own use, possession. But if they're, you know, dealing to other people, they're supplying kids, they're doing all kinds of things that truly are criminal, then there should be some charges. And then it should be adjusted to, you know, they go to treatment and they can get their record expunged if they're successful in treatment.
Right. My red line is when you hurt someone else. If you're just using for yourself, violence, great. But if you steal, if you hurt someone else, if you're dealing to someone else, then now you've crossed the red line where you're now hurting other people. It's not just about you. Right. And there needs to be deterrence for that. And I just did a podcast with a guy who had his whole life. It's an incredible, terrible life of living in a drug cartel father, violence at a young age, drug use. And he said it's compassionate to have deterrence. It's not compassion to tell you you're fine when you're not.
Yeah.
Right.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. So what happens if this goes through? Bertha also meant, also already said, loss of reliability from the DEA, FDA, the whole process. Whoever's behind it, they've lost their integrity. But what happens, in fact, to marijuana? Will you write a prescription for it? Will it be over the counter in the pharmacy? Will it be in the PDMP system?
If it is Schedule 3, they can no longer test it for safety-sensitive positions or, you know, people driving, flying people around, running.
Yeah. Do you want your pilot on marijuana?
Yeah.
Do you want your doctor? Do you want your doctor who's high?
Yeah. No, and that's, yeah, because I worked for several years for the Colorado Physician Health Program, and that became an issue when we legalized. And we were pretty clear that we didn't think it was appropriate for doctors to be using marijuana when they were practicing. And you know, my concern is I ended up seeing medical students who were actually using quite a bit of marijuana. And, you know, there's this thing called state-induced learning. It's well researched in the literature that says that if you learn something under the effect of an addictive drug, then you may only retain it when you're under the effect of the drug. That's a really scary thought. Do you want to have your doctors out there can't remember anything because now they're not smoking marijuana?
It amazes me. I learned this through the opioid epidemic because I always thought, and myself included, that doctors are the smartest. And I'd look to the older doctors and they're scientists. They went through medical schools and residency and everything. They have to know everything. But yet I just was around some young physicians and they were like surprised that I told them that, you know, smoking marijuana is not healthier than tobacco. you would think that you don't even have to be a doctor to figure out that all this smoke goes in your lung, that just because it's marijuana, it's healthier. But yet I realize through the opioid epidemic that physicians are just susceptible to the marketing and societal pressures as everybody else.
Absolutely.
We're human.
Right. So, all right. Any other consequences?
Well, I do think it's going to require a very large degree of revamping of how marijuana is dispensed, because if it's in Schedule 3 without any guardrails, without any doses, without any specific medical conditions, it's really going to be farcical in terms of the practice of medicine. So I think the FDA is going to have to step in and create a whole new set of regulations that will mandatory for prescribing it if it's done. The insurance companies are going to have to figure out if they're going to reimburse for marijuana, which they don't at this point. They don't have to, and usually they don't. There's a whole cascade, I think, of regulatory problems that are going to weigh in now. And I just think HHS has done a disservice to the country by not evaluating the cost-benefit of this decision long before they began the process. I think that is the biggest problem. I think they looked at the so-called benefits, the support for it, rather than look at what the costs are going to be in terms of the short and long term. I'm going to have to get off now, but I hope that this has been useful for everyone.
It has. Thanks, Bertha.
Thank you, Bertha. So great to have you even remotely all the way from far away to join us for this important discussion. Thank you so much.
Sure. Bye-bye.
And I think one of the things that's going to have to happen is there's going to have to be a required education for all physicians. This just isn't the physicians who are recommending or prescribing it because of the drug-drug interactions. And that was some of the stuff that I've been seeing a lot of, because I get referred patients who they've got a primary care doc who's diagnosing them with mental health problems and prescribing medications. They have a therapist who's doing their therapy. And then I get sent them because it's not working. So when I see the patient, I ask them, why am I seeing you? Well, my medication isn't working. You need to give me a better medication. And so then I get the whole history and find out they're using, and it's usually high potency THC products. And then I have to explain to them, I think the reason your medication isn't working because of your marijuana use. And they can't believe me. They don't believe me. And of course, their doctor hasn't said a thing about it.
Because they don't know. Just tell them to go to drugs.com. Yeah. Check it for themselves. That's what I tell people to do. And so the problem with education is, who is giving that education? With the opioid epidemic, it was the pharmaceutical company that were driving the education. And so we got more use and more adverse events, not better. So it's a slippery slope by asking for education. Same with the states that have, I don't have hope that if this is scheduled, it'll be better regulated, because we could look at all the states now that have quote unquote medical cannabis, and they're run by the cannabis industry, not by independent public health people. And we know it's not working because we see all the pediatric poisoning and emergency department visits and older people who are poisoned, and that those numbers are going exponentially high. And so we've seen that failed process, which HHS is saying, look at what a great process. This is why we should change the schedule.
Jeez. Yeah.
So, yeah. So
hopefully
we have.
Somebody will hear this and pay attention, and one will lead to three, will lead to 100. And, you know, maybe, you know, we can hope that, because 30, 40 years ago, you'd never see this kind of a video. It was just, the information was not out there. Nobody was taking a stand. And we are. So let's hope that it feeds on itself and grows.
All right, let's end with your quick elevator speech about rescheduling. Eric, and then Libby, tell me, why is this a bad idea?
Well, I think you'll see increased use. I think you'll see more toxicity. I think it's poorly thought out, poorly planned. And really, we need to leave things as they are. Marijuana should stay a Schedule I drug. And if people feel a need to have THC derivatives, they're available. Well, especially like as Marinol, for instance. And I think we need to leave it alone. And I'm going to push back that way.
Libby?
Well, I just think changing it to a Schedule III is a really bad idea. And my biggest beef with all this is that it doesn't spell out what they're talking about. They said, what is the definition of marijuana? So is it going to include all these high potency products? And if so, then it was a really bad idea. And then where are they going to come up with the dosing? How do we know exactly how much people can take? And then where are we going to get people educated on this, that it has multiple drug-drug interactions? And when you take away the Schedule I from it, then DOT can't test it. And so we're going to have a lot of people that are at much higher risk because other people are using the product.
Yeah. I think the public has lost confidence in medicine and public health after COVID and all the vaccines. And with this, we're going to have laws that further deteriorate public health credibility. And this is an example of that. And not to mention the international threat and weakness of the United States not following international laws. So
on that cheerful note.
On that cheerful note, we are here with Isaac to promote the science, to be there. It's very painful to be ahead of the curve, but we're there, and hopefully there's no doubt that the public will come around, and we're at the right side of history. It's just a matter of time of how long that'll take. And so I really want to thank all of you, Eric, Libby, and Bertha, for joining us and making the case, and because people are listening to us, and there's a lot of people on our side in this issue. I think it's on the side of science and on medicine and on truth.
And I would just like to offer to anybody who's on HHS that has had a role in this to talk to. I would love to talk to any of them who came up with this recommendation and to find out why and what.
Ditto.
They...
Yeah.
You know what? On the very beginning, if you read the letter from Dr. Levine, she starts it and says, this came to HHS from President Biden. So maybe we can't blame them. They were charged to fast track this process. They weren't charged to ignore the science and only promote the science that they want, but they were charged to expedite this approval. So
I would go one further step. I'd be very happy also to talk to any policymakers, and I would also offer to keep that conversation totally confidential, because I know it can be tricky to be the person standing up and pushing back, but we can certainly arm you with a tremendous amount of data and science, and that way, hopefully somebody will make some good decisions. So thank you, Renit.
It's great. No, thank you so much. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.